All right, good morning. Please be seated. The next case on this panel's argument is, argument calendar is George Arthur versus the state, case number 52046. Council ready to proceed? All right, go ahead. Mr. Waters.
May it please the court, my name is William Waters. I'm with the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Mr. George Arthur. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
It's been said, and I think even Judge Mosley said in this trial, that a criminal defendant is not entitled to a perfect trial, but he is entitled to a fair trial. And in this particular case, Mr. Arthur got neither. He did not get a perfect trial, and he did not get a fair trial. He did not get a fair trial based on a number of errors that began even before the trial started, with the state's failure to comply with statutes respecting the noticing of witnesses. The error and the unfairness to Mr. Arthur was perpetuated then throughout the trial in various instances. Before I get to those, just to provide a little context for my argument, it's very important to understand the relationship between the parties here. And although Mr. Arthur was never married to Monica Tatiana, legally married, they lived together as man and wife for about 17 years. I understand Nevada doesn't recognize common law marriage, but for all intents and purposes, they were married. They had children together. George considered Sam his father-in-law. And George had his problems, as did Sam, and as most families do. And George had an alcohol problem. And at points throughout the relationship between these parties, George would be prohibited from being around the family for various reasons. And a lot of it had to do with his alcoholism. But it was never permanent, and Mr. Arthur had never been permanently excommunicated from this family. There were periods of times where he would be told he's not welcome. A week later, he would be perfectly welcome. And so that's the context in which this case evolved. Now, during jury selection, one of the jurors, and I believe it was Ms. Rogers, indicated that she could not be fair in this particular case or could not sit on this jury if there was an allegation of domestic violence, man versus woman. And she even, I believe, said, I don't think I could be impartial because I could never understand why a man just can't assume it's over and just be done with the relationship. And at that time, we approached the bench and we said, Judge, here's the problem. Although this particular case involves George Arthur and his father-in-law, Sam, and that is domestic violence in a very technical sense of the charge, the state's aware of allegations that maybe our client might have done something to Monica at some point during the relationship. We don't have a lot of information about it, but we're concerned, based on what she said, that if that comes out at trial and she's seated at a juror, she's not going to be fair. And we don't want to necessarily voir dire on it, because we don't want to bring out the fact that there is potential domestic violence here, husband against wife domestic violence. And so in order to, I guess, rehabilitate her, Judge Mosley basically asked, well, this situation involves an older man and a younger man, and they're sort of related, but not by blood. And so you can be fair if that's the situation, correct? And she said, well, sure. And at that point, Mr. Coffey and myself felt no alternative, but with the idea that other domestic violence may come out, although we certainly had never been provided a hearing pursuant to Petrocelli to see if it was even admissible, our fear that it might come out compelled us to strike her for cause. And then, of course, it does come out. And here's how it comes out. Monica is testifying that George had been, I guess, not welcome at the house around the time that this incident occurred. And there were reasons why he wasn't allowed around the house. And Mr. Coffey, through his cross-examination, was basically trying to elicit some of the reasons why he wasn't allowed at the house. And importantly, it was because when he was drunk, they just didn't like dealing with him. And that was the extent of Mr. Coffey's cross-examination. And yet the state then argues that we somehow opened the door and that the actual reason why he wasn't allowed in there was because of this domestic violence allegation against Monica. Who knows when, who knows how, who knows where, who knows what even the allegations were. Mr. Tomczyk said to the trial court, well, there's an allegation he laid hands on her. We're left to speculate what that could possibly mean. So now domestic violence is coming into the record. And And then it's compounded again by the jail phone call. The jail phone call where Mr. Arthur calls his wife Monica and says, and references an old bench warrant. Criminal behavior would never, in the state, had this 911 call. Now, they're going to claim, well, we only got it the morning of trial. With all due respect, the police had it for over a year, or at the very least, Clark County Detention Center had it for over a year. And they're in constructive possession of that if law enforcement has it. But yet they show up the first day of trial and say, we really want to play this 911 call, giving us no opportunity to redact it prior to trial. Mr. Coffey was in an impossible situation where once the judge said, well, it's coming in, you know, I've got to run across the street for 5 minutes.
But wait a minute. I thought the judge afforded you an opportunity to redact it.
He did.
You just told me we didn't have an opportunity to redact, and I thought the record shows the judge gave you that opportunity, and you chose the next day not to redact that offending statement.
And I apologize.
Is that right?
You're absolutely right. I believe now Judge Mosley did say, would you like to redact it? And then now that you mentioned it, Mr. Coffey's response was it would draw further attention to it. I apologize. I'm getting some of the things mixed up here.
Okay.
But that is true. Yeah, and Your Honor is absolutely correct. But again, it's the hijacking us with that information, though, on a particular day when we've already prepared for trial. We're not anticipating that being an issue. And then lo and behold, here we are. We put the jury. We're ready to go. And it's, here you go. Here's a statement where that has been in our possession for a year, and your client makes some very damaging remarks on that statement. Same thing with Lori Rios, which I think is far more damaging and far more egregious, with all due respect to Ms. Nykos and Mr. Tomczyk, having failed to notice her for months, properly notice her. I apologize. They did notice her as a witness. However, they never provided an address. And the explanation that Mr. Tomczyk gave when this became an issue at trial was, well, we didn't know her address. Well, I mean, gee whiz, they spoke to her on the phone. They met with her in pretrial. That's like saying, as long as they don't ask what her address is, then I don't know, then I don't have to provide that information to the defense. I mean, it seems to me that Mr. Tomczyk, who is a very experienced district attorney, would know that he's noticed her, first of all, and he actually did say that he did notice her about a month before, because someone in the family said, look, she might know something. He said, in an abundance of caution, I put her on the witness list, but I didn't know anything else about her at that time. The moment he talks to her, either in pretrial or on the telephone, he knows what his obligation is to the defense. He knows what his obligation is by statute. At that point, you can't willfully ignore that obligation by saying, you know what, I'm not going to ask her this very important question, what her address is, and if I don't do that, then I don't have to provide the defense with it. I mean, he knows that once he's talking to her and he's already noticed her, now he intends to call her because, you know, in all candor, that information was great for them. So, you know, this wasn't a situation that I can't imagine. This is a situation where, you know, mid-trial, they were like, yeah, let's go ahead and call her. I think from day one they wanted to call her. That statement was hugely damaging to our case. And Mr. Coffey, you know, made a record about it. There are so many things we could have done with that information had we known where she was to talk to her. We certainly would have sent an investigator out there. We certainly would have at least seen what she had to say. Then we could have done independent investigation.
So are you suggesting that even after having her name for some extended period of time, the defense initiated no effort to communicate or locate this witness on their own?
Well, what I can tell you is, and this isn't part of the record, but there was a conversation between Mr. Coffey and Mr. Tomczyk, and it related to this particular witness when we were...
Well, if it isn't part of the record, you probably shouldn't be arguing that.
Well, okay, then the short answer to your question is yes, there was an effort made to try to locate this woman. By Mr. Coffey, and where she lived and what her phone number was. We weren't provided with that information, so therefore we could not contact her. I suppose we could have searched public records or something like that. I think in the context of a trial where there's a lot of things going on, that's a phenomenal burden to put on us when the state has that information. They have it. I mean, with all due respect, Justice Hardesty, I don't think that we should have to send a detective out to try to locate an individual when they've got that person's information and the statute requires them to tell us that information. So now you've got a very close case here because there's two people in a house where only know what happened there. And we're obviously arguing self-defense. The evidence supported a self-defense claim through Mr. Arthur's testimony, through the blood evidence. Mr. Coffey was very deliberate in pointing out how Mr. Arthur sustained his injuries, and by based on the blood evidence in the corner of the bedroom, that had to have been where the first blood was drawn because there was no other blood anywhere near that area. And with that, this prejudicial information about domestic violence, old bench warrants, doing crazy things. George, Monica said on the phone, George, you do these crazy things. All this information now portrays George Arthur as someone who went over there to provoke a fight, who is a crazy, violent person with the sole purpose of going over there to either assault, batter, or kill this man. When the reality is, that's not true. And the testimony was that Sam would let him in the house all the time. There's no evidence of forced entry at that house. And that will get me to the felony murder argument, but there's no evidence of forced entry. There's no evidence that he tricked him into letting him into the house. Witnesses testify when we left that night, Sam locked the door. So if George went over to that house and he knocked on the door, Sam had to have let him in. And George, who was extremely intoxicated based on his testimony, could not deceive Sam in such a way to gain his trust in that moment to allow himself access to that apartment with the intent to confront him. The reality was, George had called Monica earlier in the evening, said, I need $20, I'd like to see you tonight. She said, I'm out, I'll be home later. Wait. George is drinking, passes out in his car, drives over to the house, he sees the van, which he knows belongs to Monica. He thinks she's home. The state made a huge deal about this, parking the car 0.3 miles away, and George testified, that's not true. I parked across the street from the house. And in fact, there was no evidence that he parked his car 0.3 miles away, drove Sam's car 0.3 miles away to switch up the car. No evidence of that, but they needed that. In fact, we got the burglary charge dismissed by writ prior to trial. Mr. Tomczyk was unsatisfied with that, actually did a motion to re-argue the writ, and although nothing had really changed, Judge Mosley reversed the decision and then reinstated the burglary charge. The felony murder for them was so hugely important because there was legitimate facts and issues involving self-defense. And if they could circumvent having to prove premeditation deliberation by merely saying, you know what, he was pissed off because of a phone call, and he went over there to start trouble, and all we have to prove is he entered the door, and once we do, don't deliberate any further, that's felony murder, that's first degree, he's done. I have 2 minutes and 46 seconds left. Unless there's any questions, I'm just going to keep that for rebuttal.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Nikos?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Maureen Nikos. I represent the district attorney's office in this case. Let me kind of start where we left off with that burglary charge getting dismissed. Things did change. When Judge Mosley originally dismissed that burglary charge, I was not present. Mr. Tomczyk wasn't present. There was a calendar deputy down there, and there was very little argument on it. Judge Mosley dismissed it, a note was taken, that was the end of it. Mr. Tomczyk placed the matter back on calendar, and there's a very thorough transcript of that second hearing, where it's very clear that Judge Mosley completely missed the fact about the car being parked 0.3 miles away, and completely misapprehended that George wasn't living at this address. He was operating under the assumption that George Arthur lived at this address with Samuel Andrade and missed the whole point about the car being parked, and therefore the burglary charge was reinstated. So I just wanted to make that clarification. Defendant did get a fair trial. It was not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Things were overlooked. Things did get missed. But he was still afforded a fair trial. Let me start with Lori Rios. Lori Rios was noticed as a witness on March 12th of 2008, a month prior to trial. Her name was on the witness list, and it said address unknown. We did not know her address. And that's very clear from the record. We did not know her address, and I think actually up until the day she testified, we did not know her address.
Aren't you under a continuing duty to supplement?
We are under a continuing duty to supplement, but we never received her address. And although Mr. Waters argued that we spoke to her on the telephone, and that was argued by the defense that we spoke to her on the telephone, we never spoke to her on the telephone either. She arrived with the family in a large group. Now, should we have asked her for her address at the time? Probably. You're absolutely right. However, I do want to make something very, very, very clear, and this is very clear on the record, and I'm quoting Mr. Coffey. I'll tell you, oftentimes, they get last name unknown from the state or address unknown. That's not uncommon. What generally happens is, given the open file policy, given the fact that we're checking the state's files ongoing, that's provided if it comes up, particularly if it's a critical witness of some sort. To the extent that there was any dereliction in regards to an inquiry on this, that is entirely and ultimately my fault, meaning Mr. Coffey accepted the responsibility for not asking us, hey, we're trying to find this person. Do you have any other information to go on? And, you know, the witness notices go out without a signature from myself or Mr. Tomczyk. They're electronically filed. They're not reviewed by Mr. Tomczyk or myself before they're filed. And until it was actually brought to the state's attention, I didn't even realize there was a problem. And quoting Mr. Coffey as well, is they noticed this witness back to us on their witness list. So I didn't think there was any problem. There was no reason for Mr. Tomczyk or I to assume that they've had any trouble locating this person because they put her on their own witness list. Mr. Coffey admits to that in the record. So they had notice of her. Was it proper under the statute? No. But it's a statutory, not a constitutional violation, and it was never brought to our attention. Had it been, we have a very good working relationship with the Public Defender's Office. I would have called and made a check on that, but no effort was ever made. Now going to the jail call. I reviewed the detective's file myself. I missed it. I absolutely missed it. We saw the detective's file again before the start of trial. I believe it was the morning we were supposed to start trial. And there was a jail call in there. As we were listening to the jail call in Mr. Tomczyk's office, we emailed it to the defense. They didn't ask for a continuance based on that. No opening statements had been given yet. A jury hadn't been impaneled. They could have asked for a continuance if this threw them off their game and they weren't prepared for it. They had the opportunity to do that. Secondly, they didn't ask for any redactions. In fact, they specifically said they did not want them because they didn't want to draw attention to it. Now, if I can just describe this phone call to you. It's a conversation between Monica Tetano and George Arthur. She asked him what happened. He says, they picked me up on an old bench warrant. She says, okay. She asked about why he's in Moapa. I was buying fireworks. She asked where he was. I wasn't there. I was on Alexander Street. I told the detectives that. It's about a full 3 minutes into the phone call before she tears into him. Which she does. She yells at him, goes belligerent on him. Redactions could have been made. And this is a digital recording. This isn't like an old tape deck where you're going to hear clicks and you're going to hear stop. It's a digital recording. It can be redacted very quickly and very easily. And they didn't want that. And we shouldn't be here now arguing about all the things that were in that could have been taken out because they didn't want them taken out. Secondly, this is also not even alleged to them to be a constitutional violation, but a statutory one. And I'm quoting directly from the respondent's reply brief. The appellant's reply brief. Respondent's answering brief devotes considerable attention to the notion that the late disclosure of the recorded phone call did not amount to a constitutional violation. However, appellant didn't assert any such violation. Rather, appellant contends that the late disclosure of the recorded phone call abrogated his statutory discovery rights. That does not prompt the exclusionary rule. The exclusionary rule is reserved and has historically been reserved for cases involving the violation of fundamental constitutional rights. That's not even being alleged here. And the reason that it's reserved such way is that the exclusionary rule hides the truth. Hides the truth from that jury. It shouldn't have been applied in this case. The errors in that phone call could have been cured by a redaction that they didn't want. Now moving on to the DV testimony. What opened the door wasn't just the questioning of Monica Tetano. And I'm going to go back to the transcript. This is quoting Mr. Tomczyk. I take issue with a couple of things Mr. Coffey said, one of which would be that it was the state solicitation of specific acts. Now, we knew the specific acts, and they knew the specific acts. It was deliberately not gone into, and it was discussed at the bench as far as we could go with that line of questioning, and it was a very limited line of questioning. But going on to the transcript, and this is again Mr. Tomczyk, that line of questioning was entered into on behalf of defense by Mr. Coffey and both of those witnesses, and it was covered in great detail. He went into it with Chrissy Tatano about the fact that he was a problem drinker. He asked Chrissy Tatano when there was some drinking if he acted like a little child. Ms. Nikos and I discussed that at that point, and we didn't feel that they quite opened the door at that point. But then we go on to Monica Tatano, and again, that line of questioning. Well, he drinks, and he's kind of a problem, and you have to treat him like a child sometimes. And Mr. Tomczyk was right that the paper transcript doesn't do it justice because there was this little action going along with it, sort of portraying George Arthur to be this bolsado, kind of silly little bumbling drunk like from the Barney Miller show. I mean, and which is not the case at all. And the jury was absolutely entitled to get a fair depiction of why he wasn't allowed in that house when he'd been drinking. And the line of questioning was very, very limited. And the controlling case when the door is opened is Taylor v. State. And that basically takes us out of the realm of Petrocelli because this is not something that is sought by the state in its case in chief. There's no Petrocelli hearing needed. They open the door. They put in front of that jury a very, very, very inaccurate picture of what this guy was like. And the state has a right under Taylor v. State to correct that. And it was done in a very limited purpose, and it was very proper, and it was very fair.
Well, what about Tavares? There was no limiting instruction given either. And
my reading, I'm sorry.
Just Taylor doesn't seem to me to address that.
Taylor does not address Tavares. My reading of Tavares is that a limiting instruction is not required. However, under Tavares, even if this court is to find the limiting instruction was required, it's a harmless error review. And what we're talking about here is overwhelming evidence. Overwhelming. Mr. Arthur got up there and put up this theory of self-defense because he's got a cut here and a cut here up against Samuel Andrade, who was sliced across the throat 3 separate times at least, almost decapitated. It was all the way back through his windpipe. Stabbed through his skull, which is very hard, at least 11 times. The medical examiner stopped counting at 11. His brain had been morcellated, which means it was just pulpified mush. His skull had been shredded. The other were to his back. It's so overwhelming. Then Mr. Arthur cleans it up. But he doesn't remember doing that. But he cleans it up. They luminol that bathroom because they couldn't figure out where all the blood was. And I really wish we could bring you pictures. Because the blood was overwhelming in that bathroom. He cleaned that up. He got into the victim's car. And he parked it 3/10 of a mile away. Almost half a mile away. And now, Mr. Waters downplays the significance of that. But he bleeds inside Mr. Andrade's car, leaving his own blood and Mr. Andrade's blood. He then gets into his own car, and there's his own blood and Samuel Andrade's blood. Now, this jury had a very, very reasonable inference to draw, is that he didn't want to walk to his own car covered in blood. So yes, his own car was parked 3/10 of a mile away. That's the only rational conclusion there, despite what Mr. Arthur testified to. Because, let's be honest, the jury had the opportunity to either accept or reject Mr. Arthur's testimony. They chose to reject it. Now let's go to, I want to address the felony murder, because it was brought up by Mr. Waters. Now, this wasn't only charged as felony murder. I'm reading, count 2, defendant being responsible under one of the following principal liabilities: 1, by having premeditation and deliberation in its commission; and or two, the killing occurred during perpetration or attempted perpetration of a burglary. For the purpose of the felony murder, burglary was charged as follows: assault and or battery and or a felony. And for the purpose of the felony murder, assault and or battery was what we were relying on, and that's what was argued. And that, under Contreras, is acceptable by this court. This court actually specifically rejected that California Wilson case and held that, yes, we can use assault or battery, you know, for the burglary, for purposes of felony murder. That's completely acceptable. And the rationale was very clear, is that out on the street, there's an opportunity to escape. Inside that closed residence, it's a lot more difficult, and it creates a greater risk of harm and death. And that's a very, very important distinction to make. And California missed it. We caught it. And we caught it in 2002. And, you know, the appellant puts in their briefs that, well, that doesn't really take into account, actually, I'll quote directly, "This rationale carries very little weight where modern-day homicides are concerned." Going on, that the rationale is lost on both modern-day homicides and the instant fact. Well, 2002, I think, is a modern-day homicide. I don't think anything's changed since 2002, and there's absolutely no reason to retreat from Contreras, which is what the appellant is asking us to do here. Now, to the extent that the appellant is arguing that if the juror found that the intention wasn't assault or indoor battery, but it was murder, then I'm in complete agreement that they shouldn't find felony murder. I'm in agreement with that. You're not going to hear any argument from me that if they think that the basis of the burglary was murder, it's not felony murder. That's absolutely correct. It's not felony murder. It's willful, premeditated, and deliberate murder, which is still first-degree murder. So there's absolutely no real argument to be had here on claiming that this is, you know, an improper pleading, because either way, it's going to be first-degree murder. But unfortunately, we can't climb inside Mr. Arthur's head and find out exactly what it was that he had on his mind. But he had something terrible on his mind. Otherwise, he wouldn't have parked that car so far away. He was angry at Samuel Andrade. He wasn't allowed at that house. He was 86. He was mad. And he's not a happy drunk. He showed up there. He killed him quite brutally. He cleaned up after himself. He lied to his friend Nathaniel Schwartz about how he got these two little cuts on his body. He takes the police on a 38-mile high-speed chase on the wrong side of the highway, then takes off running from them. Then he gets on the phone with his wife and says, "I wasn't even there." That's the truth. Those are the facts. Defendant got a fair trial. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Nichols.
Ms. Nyko said no effort was made to ascertain the location or anything with respect to Lori Rios, and that is flat out wrong. I was in Mr. Coffey's office when we contacted Josh Tomczyk from the district attorney's office. We said, "Give us a phone number. You've noticed her. Why'd you notice her?" "Well, she's a witness. I don't, we're probably not going to call her." And then he says something very important. In a completely different conversation, he says, "Your guy said that he was sent to Earth to kill Sam." He knew what she was going to testify to. He had already spoken to her. He had an obligation to update that witness list at that particular point, and he chose not to. He chose not to ask her address so that they didn't have to provide it to us, so that they could stand up here, accuse us of doing nothing, and say, "Well, we didn't ask, so we weren't required to provide it."
Mr. Walters, you made the argument before, but the state pointed to something that I had missed earlier. Had the defense listed Ms. Rios on their witness list?
As is customary, Judge, we did. And as is customary, we usually, and this has happened to me in my own personal practice, we will re-notice everyone they notice in case there's a witness on there that they choose not to call that we do want. And this happened to me in a trial recently where I actually had to end up calling a detective because the state chose not to call that detective. So as a matter of course, we usually, just to be thorough, we'll just re-notice every witness they've noticed in the event that there's a witness that they choose not to call so that they can't say, well, they didn't provide a witness notice with respect to that witness.
But by noticing that witness with, I guess, the same no information, do you likewise undertake a responsibility to find the witness on your own?
In a very strict sense, Judge, you might be right. as a practical matter, it is a thing that we do to be thorough. In, like I said, in the event that there is a witness that we do know about, that we do know who's going to testify a particular way, and the state chooses not to call that witness, we want to have the ability to call them nevertheless. And that's why it was done. And again, we had this conversation with Mr. Tomczyk. And
wait, on that, do you have a record site for what you're representing to us?
And I apologize. I was a little worked up because Ms. Nykos got up here and said no.
I understand that, and I'm sympathetic to that. But is it in the record?
It is not. It was not. That was a conversation that occurred in Mr. Coffey's office at the Public Defender's office, and I presume Mr. Tomczyk's office at the
But that conversation is not memorialized in an affidavit or even representations orally to the judge?
It is not, Judge.
Thank you.
Now, with respect to 911 call, Mr. Coffey was obviously lead counsel on this case, and Mr. Coffey is an outstanding attorney. And he made a decision based on the fact that he thought, I guess, if I can speculate as his thinking there, that perhaps trying to redact it, I guess, would draw, can I just finish this one thought?
Yes, of course.
Would draw undue attention to it. And I'll accept that if that's what he was thinking, you know, he is, like I said, an outstanding attorney, and I'll accept that that's what he was feeling about it. Now, the state says, well, they chose not to redact it. Well, the problem is in their answering brief, they say that, I mean, they concede that they wanted to get into this stuff because it was hugely relevant to rebut our claim of self-defense. So with all due respect to Ms. Nykos, I can't imagine if Mr. Coffey showed up to court with a redacted copy which removed all that information, I promise you both she and Mr. Tomczyk would be arguing, well, hold on, we need that in. It's relevant for this purpose because they're claiming self-defense and he actually lied to her on the phone and said he was never at the house. That's why. That's what they've certainly argued in their brief. They didn't concede in their brief that it had Mr. Coffey redacted a copy of the 911 call, they would have been completely okay with that and would have played that instead of the one that they actually did end up playing for the jury. So, you know, with all due respect, I think there was a reason why they wanted that particular 911 call into evidence. There's a reason why they wanted those damaging statements that he makes on the call about the bench warrant and George do crazy things into evidence. So, and with that, I have nothing further unless there's any other questions.
I have one more question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
On the failure to give a limiting instruction, the state argues that Taylor didn't require it, but if one was required, the error, if any, in not giving one was harmless. Could you comment on that?
Well, I can't imagine. And she talked a lot about the facts of this particular case, and no doubt about it, Mr. Andrade was, there was blood and everything that you would think in a particular case of this, but that doesn't necessarily mean that at the moment that George Arthur did these things, he was not acting in self-defense. This was a very close case, absent all this prejudicial information. I mean, if the jury doesn't hear about any of this, they're left with, well, two people are in there, and sometimes they get along, sometimes they don't get along, and Sam had invited him in a week before. He's there. You know, George is cut first. It's such a closed case, it can't be harmless. It has to be harmful because once the jury hears that he's an abusive jerk who beats up his wife, I don't think they need to go much further in considering our legitimate self-defense claim. They presume that he's the violent aggressor, as he has been in the past. So with all due respect to Ms. Nykos, it is not harmless error. To the extent a limiting instruction should have been asked for by the state or supplied by the judge, that wasn't done here. I think that alone amounts to reversible error.
Any other questions for Mr. Waters?